Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast. This is the weekly show. This is number 6 in the design and build series. And today we're going to be talking about considerations for your data center with a data. Let's put it this way. Some of you people have gotten really excited about wanting to virtualize your networks. Some of you have heard us talking about network virtualization going, I don't think I need that. And in and amongst that conversation, there has been VXLAN that is discussed as one of the encapsulation types that you might use in a network virtualization scenario. So that's what I thought we'd tear down and discuss today in this design and build number 6 in the series. Why would you do network virtualization? Why would you use a VXLAN overlay? Why wouldn't you? And then if you do choose to go down this road, what are the design considerations that you need to keep in mind as you begin to put this system together? So I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. This is the Packet Pushers Podcast at Packet Pushers, and packetpushers.net is home base for us. With me is my co-host, Greg Farrow.
How are you, Mr. Banks? It's been a while since I've been on one of these particular shows, designing and the building thing.
Well, designing and building is what you and I have done historically, and so it's extremely fitting.
Yeah, but you haven't been inviting me to these shows. You've been doing it all yourself. Well, you're keeping it to yourself.
Because I'm embarrassed about what you might say. I'm scared. It fills me with anxiety. Oh, geez, if I bring Farrow on the show, he might intimidate an audience member, one of the guests. He might say something off the cuff and upset a vendor again.
I say entertain.
Well, Mr. Farrow, thank you for joining us today.
As always, it's a disgusting privilege.
And let's introduce our guests. Starting off with a man who is recovering from a cold, who's all the way early in the morning on the other side of the planet in Australia. Mr. Anthony Burke, would you introduce yourself to the Packet Pushers audience?
And with my sexy voice, I'm Anthony Burke. I am a systems engineer for VMware who works on NSX product. I am writer at Network Inferno, and I am at Pandam_ on Twitter. And I am a Tech Field Day alumni, so I've been one of the crew for a little while now, and it's nice to be back with the extended family.
Yes, and your voice does sound a bit desperate. That cold did hit you a bit, it would seem.
Oh, it sounds like you could pay me by the hour. Let's put it that way.
Also joining us is Richard Alexander. Richard, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, guys. So Richard Alexander. I'm the solutions director for Logicalis over in the UK. We're a big Cisco Gold partner and VMware, NetApp, IBM, HP. So cover a lot of technologies. I come from a really strong financial services technical background. Been in the industry for a fair old while. We've seen and done a lot. And in fact, I'm a second time now veteran of this particular podcast, and really looking forward to chatting to you guys again.
Well, thanks for coming on one more time. And another veteran of Packet Pushers is Lucas Kratiger from Cisco. Lucas, introduce yourself.
Thanks a lot, Ethan. I'm Lucas Kratiger, as said, working many years in the industry, and I did something like, I can't remember what it was, but it was before the times of IP. I think BGP started at the time, and Greg came up and didn't like that protocol at that time already. So no, jokes beside. I'm working in the industry, doing plumbing, meaning networking for many, many years, did some CCIE stuff, other industry affiliations, and in the meantime, working in Cisco Mothership in San Jose, doing a lot around data center, routing, unicast, multicast, VXLAN, and I was thinking this is a good chance to talk with you guys again.
Well, all right. Thanks for coming on. And let's start by level setting with all of you in the audience. There's a big question here. On Packet Pushers, we talk a lot about software-defined networking. Network virtualization is one of the applications that has come up that can benefit from SDN and from a controller and so on. And VXLAN is one of the protocols that is used in a network virtualization scenario. And a lot of times we lump all this together. We know because when you write to us, some of you say things like, I can't keep up with all these conversations. I don't know when I'd use a lot of this. It doesn't seem to apply to me. And so I think it's a good, before we really get into why, the what and the how of, you know, VXLAN and an overlay and tying it into an underlay, maybe we should talk about why would you do this? What is a good use case for VXLAN? And I think these three guys can help us out here. You know, Richard, as you're dealing with customers and so on, what are the scenarios you see where doing network virtualization with VXLAN is desirable?
Yeah, so there's quite a few scenarios, really, but I think the one that comes up more often than not is around just the whole vMotion story. There's still a hell of a perception out there around, you know, the extension of layer two between data centers. And fundamentally, I think it comes down to, I had this this conversation with a client not very long ago, actually, about 2 or 3 days ago, about, you know, layer two versus layer three. And it kind of boils down to the simplicity versus risk mitigation story, you know. So you guys that do know me and others that do, you know, I'm a layer three person through and through. I kind of, the need for layer two in my mind is, it's just not worth the risk. I've been burned too many times with the giant layer two broadcast storms and mega loops bringing down, well, you know, entire European networks. So I'm terrified of it. And I think extending layer two further and further, it kind of, the simplicity is not good enough. It for my mind, you need smarter application developers, you know, smarter applications. And really, I think it boils down to VXLAN is one of those protocols that is removing that risk around, you know, layer two forwarding semantics, the flooding domain, and the ease of being able to take a virtual server or indeed a physical server from one location to the next without worrying about having to change fundamental IP addressing, you know, the default gateways, et cetera, et cetera. It solves that big problem for me. It really is about, right, you know, I don't really care where your application lives. I will build you a rock solid layer three underlay network, and I'll let VXLAN and all the intelligence baked in there worry about those forward in semantics at layer two to basically make sure that, you know, everyone can talk to everyone. And that really is the key message for me when we go and talk to clients about VXLAN.
So I can play devil's advocate there and counter that, well, if the applications weren't so hung up on having to have the same IP address and all that, and we would just stand up two data centers with unique IP address space, maybe we could get away without an overlay altogether. But is your suggestion that VXLAN is the networking piece that overcomes a whatever is a bridge too far for application architectures?
Not so much. I think that the big thing there is, like you say, so you've got two separate data centers and guys are looking at moving virtual machines between two data centers that span layer three subnets. It's easy enough to use things like VMware's SRM, for example, to script a workload that changes default gateways, or necessarily are you going to use the HSR, what do you want to call them? Essentially, they are fudges, you know, HSRP fudges or any other sort of like layer two virtualization technology to make sure you can move layer three workloads between sort of different data centers. It's just fundamentally, I find that, you know, the application developers, they don't need to worry or don't want to worry about network and semantics. Their job is to develop an application that meets a business outcome. You know, they are coming back to the network guys and saying, look, the application does what it needs to do. As an application, you worry about the network side for me. That's why we pay you guys a lot of money. You're all very smart and, you know, you've got more than enough TLAs to fix any single problem the world could possibly throw at you. So, I mean, that's generally the feedback I get, is that the application guys don't want to worry about the network. They just want the application to do what the application needs to do, independent of where it happens to be hosted.
Mm. Lucas, as you deal with customers on the Cisco side, what are the use case scenarios coming your way?
One thing which is always coming up is definitely this overall L2 semantic requirement. Is it either for use cases of migrating virtual machines or also the use cases of clustering protocols? But even more, what we see tends to be an issue, and I'm not 100% sure about, is the namespace itself. Whenever it comes up, the an amount of VLANs available in a layer 2 classic Ethernet network tends to be not enough. The semantic of the VLAN, which is network-wide, is too rigid, so people try to introduce VLAN translation and stuff like that, while VXLAN actually introduced this naturally by using a different namespace in the overlay network itself. So that's one thing we're seeing there. Some other of the very major things, they were already said. I mean, building a layer 3 network is stable and solid for decades. We have routing protocols. We have a lot of built-in control plane functionality, which allows us to make L3 networks really scale and really efficient, while on the Ethernet side, on the classic layer 2 side, the only protocol which we actually had was spanning tree, which dumped down my network to a single tree. All of these kind of things, people are attracted to use VXLAN to have this all forwarding kind of network semantic. Yes, we also had some MAC encapsulation somewhere in between after Ethernet, but it tends that the layer 3 based underlay is one of the pieces where customers are very attracted to and see that as a very solid and evolved technology and solution.
And Mr. Burke, from a VMware perspective, when customers are going down this road, what are the use cases that are driving them towards network virtualization and maybe doing some work with VXLAN?
Most times, and I think as stated earlier, is the fact that people want to move older styled applications around and just maintain layer 2 connectivity. If you want to push their app developers under the bus and say, because they don't know how to build applications and they require layer 2 adjacency, preserving that layer 2 adjacency. When I speak to customers, the tech guys say to me, my CEO says, I must have this application migrate between data center A and data center B. And how do I solve that challenge? How have we traditionally solved that challenge? We stick layer 2 between data centers. We have the swing to switching moment where we go, we've got to stretch layer 2, and there are many ways to do that and skin a cat. And we have this active standby or active site with kludges in the middle. Where we see customers and people talk to me about what VXLAN is, they see, I suppose it's a bit between them. It's between the marketing side and the reality. And this is something I say, and this is no VMware hat on, no, this is just Anthony saying it. VXLAN is to VLANs, is to what IPv6 is to IPv4. Those who wield a VXLAN as an overlay solution to gain independence for a workload are those who see the real benefits in IPv6 for scale, for speed to deployment. Those who you still use IPv4 are the same ones who still use VLANs who have less of the requirement. I think it's a nice to have for many people, but not everyone requires it. Applications being built in a way that no longer require layer 2 connectivity that are being built independent of the infrastructure. You look to where applications are moving towards microservice architectures. Independence of the infrastructure isn't required from a layer 2 point of view because they're building layer 3 applications that are modern.
Yeah, so what you're saying there is that today's applications, you know, your legacy applications, your Oracles and your, you know, the J2EE systems that were built 15 years ago and are now the backbone of businesses, have none of this modern microservices capability. They don't run in Docker containers. They barely run in VMs. I mean, the vendors often don't even certify them to run in VMs and you run them in there anyway. And their attachment to the network is NIC IP address done, right? They're not even aware that a network exists. They just know it communicates magically. Is that what you're sort of pointing at, Anthony?
Absolutely. The applications that I'm in, and even if you do virtualize them, yes, they probably license you for every single host in the cluster, right?
So from my point of view, I've seen a couple of different reasons why VXLAN is coming into the data center. I've worked in with a couple of customers where they have a data center where they have a lot of, as you say, legacy apps. And there's two ways of doing it. One way is to build a new system where you're building virtualization-focused, VM-focused type applications, and you want those VMs to be highly mobile. They'll be in a new data center or in a new colo, and you need to bridge the colo into your existing data center so that you can migrate them from one place to the other. And the easiest way to do that is to layer to extend them between the data center and then, you know, as was pointed out, layer 2 is a huge amount of technical data attached to layer 2, but these apps have no other way. You can't rapidly change the DNS. The client apps that use them can't be reprogrammed to change the IP addresses of the server hosts, can't change host files. So you're really stuck at the end of the day with this. So one application is migration. So migrating VMs from one data to the other, even if you mean to do it once, you should plan to leave data centers on a regular basis. Data centers aren't going to last very long, maybe every 3 to 5 years before your colo agreements move out, and then you want to move on to the next one. So you need to plan application mobility for colo is one thing I've built. The second one I've built is customers who want to get high availability, which was touched on. That is, you know, legacy apps need high availability. The best you can do for high availability, and when I mean best, I mean the least worst high availability you can build, is to put them in a VM and then make it so that it's mobile between two physical data centers. And then they imagine The hard part here is that people imagine that I want high availability to be instantaneous. These apps should never go out. But these apps were never designed to have that feature. You couldn't not make them go out. The original idea behind the design of those applications was they should be shut down and then they should move and they'll be out for 4 hours, 12 hours, 2 days before they come back up. And I was there in the 70s and 80s when these applications, that was deemed as perfectly acceptable and quite why we do this in 2015. You know, well, we do because we can. You know, we can incur all kinds of technical debt to solve that problem. So that's the second one. And the third one and the final one, which is much more modern and much more new, used for overlay networks and the modern style of overlay builds, is a customer wants to build something new, but over here is my existing stuff. I don't want to fiddle with any of my existing stuff. I don't want to change. I don't want to add any more VLANs because I'm frightened that adding VLANs will break my spanning tree. So what I do is I start building a VXLAN overlay and then start putting all my apps in that, and I get all the features of an overlay network, which we'll talk about no doubt as we go on, and it's all separate. It's not going to mix it in with all that legacy stuff because that legacy stuff is fragile and I'm frightened it might break and I don't want to change the VLANs and I'm scared of spanning tree in my LAN. I don't change anything anymore. If I build an overlay, then I can fiddle around with it to my heart's content. I don't need to use change control. I don't need to have any legacy. I don't need to declare it in my ITIL pro. I just go take it over here. And because it runs in an overlay, I don't care about the physical infrastructure underneath. Three use cases that I see.
Now, that last one is the one that I thought would be, you know, most prevalent talking to, you know, to our guests here. You know, the idea of, again, virtualizing the network for the purpose of network virtualization in the spirit of VLANs that we've had back in the day, .1Q tags, as just an evolution of that, where you can build containerized networks that are separate from one another and have that done in your data center. And it gives you some freedom of design and not having to touch the core network, as you were pointing out, Greg, but being able to build this virtual network on top. And not impact anything else that's going on. Useful for security functions, useful for that experiment that you want to try. And yet that's not the use case that most customers seem to be using it for today. It's used more for, in the real world, for that layer two extension, for that maintaining adjacency between servers that are in different places, giving application portability or mobility to applications that really weren't designed for it. So you don't have to, you know, take away the network underpinnings from that application. You can have it keep all the networking it was used to and move it, and it's still fine. And you got VXLAN that's doing the stitching to keep those two networks adjacent, no matter what the geographic space. That said, that's not what I really think of as a data center interconnect, which someone just typed the same thing into our Google Doc here that we're using live to record this show. Lucas, was that you?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, to me, data center interconnect, there are some dedicated protocols for that, like Cisco OTV. And, you know, so this, again, it's not the application that the use case that I expected you guys to be citing. Did you want to comment any more on, a little more, Lucas, on VXLAN is not DCI?
Yeah, just let me do one or two sentences here. I mean, VXLAN tends to be used or tends to be looked at that it works perfectly with A3 networks, and that's exactly how it's being built for. But when we're looking at it in contrast to a data center interconnect, there are many things which are actually missing in there, like true multi-homing, layer 2 loop protection, flood protections, and all of these things. They're all not there. And we did quite some extensive testing within our business units on how applicable is VXLAN in regards of DCI, data center interconnect. And it really is as a pure encapsulation, but you need to build a couple of things around that, like control plane, like multi-homing implementations, in order to make it a true DCI technology there. And I just don't want that people running there and saying, hey, VXLAN, DCI, I build all my worldwide data center interconnect, especially maybe even hypervisor to hypervisor, and then you get that crazy meltdown going on like you probably also had on layer 2 networks back in the time, and that's really not what we want. So build it purposely.
Right. In other words, you can use VXLAN like you could use any other sort of a tunneling technology to stitch together these two layer 2 endpoints that happen to be separated by several layer 3 networks. Stitch and bring them together, but it doesn't mean you should necessarily, and it doesn't make the problems inherent in doing such a thing go away. You mentioned multi-homing as a challenge, you know, traffic tromboning, and there's a number of posts that are out there on the internet that explain okay, you just moved one server from data center A to data center B, and you've got traffic going through it. What do your traffic patterns to your clients look like now? And then explaining how all of that works and what you can do to make sure traffic patterns stay optimized and so on. It's it gets to be a big deal.
Let me just have a go there. Like, the thing is that VXLAN for most people is actually DCI, in the same way that if you're using EOMPLS to do the same thing, right? What Lucas is pointing out is if you just deploy VXLAN or EOMPLS in ignorance and think you've just solved the DCI problem, you haven't. Exactly. There are hidden technical debts that you incur. You still haven't managed to solve broadcast domains or spanning tree loops that might occur. You will fail.
Think about layer 3 tromboning. Think about your classic first-hop gateway and the routing stat. Yeah, sorry for that.
Great. Yeah. No, that's fine. And, you know, and the thing is that you can do this, you can solve these problems and get the host continuity, but you don't necessarily get optimal access. So if you move a host from data center A to data center B, but the traffic for the host still might come through data center A and then cross over the data center interconnect to the other side. Now you've got a 10 gig pipe between data centers that's costing you $20,000, $50,000 a month because you might have moved your data over there. Now, the thing is that if you then move your VM from one side to the other, let's just cover off some of these things. If you move a VM from data center A to data center B and you think that's high availability, let's think about in data center A, let's say you've got 1,000 VMs on the left-hand side and all of a sudden you've got a high availability event and you're going to vMotion as part of your failover. How long do you think it will take you to move 1,000 VMs, Ethan?
Depends a lot on latency. It depends a lot on available bandwidth, but a ridiculous amount of time.
Right? Yeah. Each one is going to take 5 to 10 minutes to vMotion to achieve synchronization over a link. And so if each one takes 5 to 10, now it's not necessary, a certain amount of them can occur in parallel. Each one's going to eventually, we can probably do 20 to maybe 40 at a time, but it's going to take hours and probably days for them to go across. And that's assuming you have the storage data replicated from point A to point B and you've got the routing problem from the front end. So if data center A goes offline, does your routing switch over to data center B? Even though the routing might still be announced out the front of A because the servers are down, but the routers might be up or the firewalls might be up. It's very complicated.
I definitely agree with the bandwidth part between data centers there. In terms of the world I live in here, I live in a world that does have ways to solve ingress optimization and egress optimization from multi-site, so using VXLAN. Some of these issues do go away. So if you're using VXLAN for application connectivity between two sites, there's ways to deal with ingress optimization through, if it's advertising host routes based on event-driven injection of a host route. And so when you've got an application moving to side, we aren't necessarily tromboning on ingress on site local IDs. Allow us to look at how we egress out of a particular site. Definitely agree with there is a disaster event if you are, as Richard made reference earlier, using something like SRM and a disaster event occurs and you do fail the entire data center over. Yes, you may take hours, tens of hours, days to move the workloads across if there are no other mechanisms running. So I do agree in native VXLAN where you're not using any other solutions such as NSX or other solutions that provide other services. If you're using VXLAN for connectivity of workloads with nothing else, there is a whole heap of considerations. When there are other overlay solutions in play that provide other services, you can tick some of these things off the list, which are, you know, caveats and downsides to using VXLAN as a DCI.
That's beautiful. I would agree to that. And this is exactly what we did exactly this just recently with OTV. We added another encapsulation type. We actually added the VXLAN encapsulation type to the same DCI technology umbrella, which we built for OTV. We just exchanged VXLAN as an encapsulation, and it works perfectly. But VXLAN itself is nothing else than the data plane encapsulation.
So that's a long way for us to say we've got some typical use cases of what people may be using VXLAN for, which may be different from what it was initially conceived to do, and then all of the caveats if you're trying to do stretching layer 2 between data centers, that what all that is getting at. And there's been a lot written on that, but it isn't what we wanted to tear down specifically in this show, even though that's what we spent the first 25 minutes doing.
It always happens.
I know, right? So let's move by the caveats for a minute. And I think, you know, I think we've made a very, you know, key point here. You know, if you're considering this problem, you've got this challenge of host between data centers and the layer two adjacency is a big deal to you, et cetera. You got a lot of reading to do if you're not familiar with what traffic pattern problems that introduces into your life. They are considerable, and there's many solutions out there and ways to handle those issues. So keep all that in mind. Let's say, for whatever our application, we've decided that we are going to build a VXLAN as an overlay in our data center. And Richard, you've been quiet for a bit. Let's go back to you. If you're discussing this with a customer, trying to describe this technology to them as a network engineer, what are the major elements of this solution?
Depending on the nature of the client, we try to keep it relatively straightforward. I mean, think most of the guys that you speak to that have got any sort of technical sense are aware of the fact that, you know, ultimately it's nothing more than a different type of encapsulation. You know, you're not going to try and sell it to them any other way. I think sort of like the key things for me around are explaining the real big components. So understanding the 24-bit VNet identifier, to basically quantify the increased subnet space or VLAN space, if you would. You know, basically there's far more scale in it. Although, just to add a caveat to that, certainly in the enterprise space, it's very seldom that I come up against a client that says my 4,096 VLANs are not enough. That happens.
Yes.
Not a lot, yes, in the enterprise space. So selling it on the fact that 16 million segments, the guy goes, yeah, thanks very much, mate. I just want a white one and a black one. That'll do. So that's hard to sell. I mean, component-wise, like I say, it's obviously the encapsulation, identifying the segments, but really for me, it's about sort of talking around the concept of the VTEPs and how the VTEPs talk to each other and the information sort of like that they obviously contain within themselves and what's advertised between them in terms of, like I say, making sure that those layer two versus layer three, so obviously the VXLAN bridging versus VXLAN routing semantics are explained.
So with VTEP, we're getting into kind of the meat and potatoes here, because we're talking about VXLAN tunnel endpoints. If you've never heard of VXLAN before, you know, you could build a GRE interface. You probably built this on a routing device, and you've got a tunnel interface. Okay, so the tunnel endpoint is the physical endpoint that tunnel is pinned to. You have VXLAN tunnel endpoints as well, commonly called VTEPs. And how do you explain a VTEP to them, Richard?
Yeah, so ultimately, for me, I say, you've got to sort of take a VTEP as being it almost like synonymous with a switch, and it basically understands all of the hosts that sit behind it, and then it has its an IP address that it basically advertises, hi, I'm, a VTEP at IP address X, and these are all the hosts that I'm aware of. So it basically then advertises to what I, to put it mildly, like a VXLAN cloud, is that it has reachability to all of these hosts. And so then when you come into sort of like the control plane semantics for VXLAN is the next bit around sort of like how VTEPs talk to each other. And the next step of the conversation is around sort of the multicast control plane versus the EVPN address family, BGP. So
let's just back up one second here. So a VTEP knows a few different things, as you stated. He needs to know the hosts that sit behind him, and he also needs to know what other VTEP to talk to if he needs to deliver a frame to another endpoint. Which VTEP do I basically build a tunnel to and shunt the frame through it so that it gets delivered out to the other side? And that then gets into the control plane discussion, which VXLAN, as originally conceived by the IETF, has no control plane. It uses multicast groups to communicate and share that data, which for a lot of people is kind of like, not running multicast. Don't really want to be turning on PIM so all the VTEPs can learn this information. Which brings you to, you were just mentioning EVPN and then using BGP as a control plane to do this.
Yeah, and I'll tell one of the things, and the other guys jump in as well, but one of the biggest no's I've had around explaining to clients, because, granted, VXLAN, it's starting to gain market traction, but, we were talking to this to clients, a year and a half ago, before the EVPN address family was available. That's relatively new, but you go to a client and say, VXLAN is going to solve a particular issue for you, but I'm going to ask you please to turn on multicast over the entire core of your network. Unless it's there already, which you know, if you're talking to financial organizations, it's not a problem. Very seldom do you go into an organization in the financial services market that's not running a version of PIM. But, you know, other enterprise spaces, when you say, I want you to turn on multicast throughout the core of your network, there's a huge pushback because, you know, multicast is very easy to turn on. But anyone that's ever tried to troubleshoot it will know that it is definitely not the easiest thing in the world to get to the bottom of a problem.
My problem is that every vendor IP multicast solution I've worked with is a miserable, disgusting failure. It never works the way it does. It's full of bugs. It has memory leaks. Getting a code version and getting tech support from the vendor is hopeless. No one knows how to run the technology, not even the vendor themselves. And I have tried once, just recently, just in the last 3 months, I've been running a PIMBiter implementation on a vendor's high-density data center switching at 40 gigabits per second. And what a miserable, sad waste of my life that's been. And this is the last time I will ever muck around with multicast. It can go on itself for all I care.
It's hard work.
Also across different switch vendors to switch models as well. If you're working on multi-vendor environment or multi even switch variant environment, then have different code trains. It compounds that issue too.
I'm talking about a basic ECMP network. I've got 12 switches in a spine. I've got 36 switches in a leaf layer. All I want to do is turn on PIMBiter. Just dumb PIMBiter, right? That's it. And that did
work. Let's go buy a beer. Yeah, it's easier to buy a beer than turn that thing. Yeah, I agree.
I've wasted days of my life in pointless discussions and and the vendor's just sitting there going, we don't know. And the developer who wrote it left 3 months ago, or, you know, they've got no idea what the hell they're doing, or they bought the code from, say, subbed out the code to somebody else. IP multicast is a complete waste of time.
Okay, Greg's hatred of multicast aside and the complexity of implementing it from a real-world perspective, I don't know of anyone that's had great experiences with multicast. When, you know, getting to the point here with VXLAN, by default, it's the flood and learn methodology using multicast. That is how VTEPs learn what hosts are behind one another and how they are supposed to build tunnels.
But that was the theory behind it, but nobody actually deployed it. I mean, even when NSX released the first, vCloud Director released the first version of VTEP and VXLAN overays, it used IP multicast flooding to shift the MAC address information around. Zero people bought that and deployed it, except for some fools who believe the rubbish that comes out of big vendors' mouths because they're our trusted partners. But it failed very quickly, and vCloud Director 5.1 lasted about 3 months before it was deprecated. Nobody's using multicast and VTEP.
I just wanted to point out we have two big and trusted vendors on the call right now.
Well, that was spoken like a true network engineer, let's be honest.
You notice I didn't actually mention names. I was being really nice.
Oh, come on. No, so I see absolutely the point you're making here, Greg. And I'm talking to so many customers exactly about this piece in VXLAN. There are two things which need to be contrasted there in saying, hey, no multicast, never. I mean, many people are not aware how multicast actually works. So it's an operational boundary which also has to be stepped over in order to get all these guys, the operation folks, understanding how that actually works there. But when we're looking back into the Ethernet times, we used multicast in order to distribute multi-destination traffic. I mean, a broadcast is nothing else than a specialized multicast. So we're using multicast for years, but just nobody cared.
I'm going to get upset now. Now you're conflating IP multicast with Ethernet multicast. There's Ethernet multicast.
Not exactly. I'm just talking about multi-destination traffic. Let's compare it one-on-one. I'm just talking about the necessariness of having multi-destination traffic in a network, which we used kind of a way to use it as efficient as possible back in the times. With ingress replication or head-end replication, which can accommodate that avoiding of multicast in VXLAN, is there. It's present. It is a feature how I send a given packet, which I previously only sent once, to every of my neighbors. So I start multiplicating that single packet multiple times, depending on the amount of neighbors I have. And when we're looking at, we try to optimize networks by using L3. Now we're putting an L2 overlay on top of it, and now we're making everything bad again. All the optimization we actually brought in by multiplicating packets for bump traffic, for example. I mean, it is a question optimization versus I don't care and I just don't want to use a particular protocol. And it goes into religion. And I see customer going in one or the other direction. But ingress replication, when we look at it really in detail on what it does, it's not nice. But I get your point on additional control plane protocols, multicast control plane protocols, people not being very confident with that stuff. I mean, that's reality, yes. But there is also reality in the what it actually does to you when you go into a unicast forwarding mode.
Well, I think there's a bigger point here in that we've got, you know, multicast was in the background of VXLAN in the very early days. But, right, not very many people implemented it because there were other ways and better ways to get that information across. And so, Richard, maybe I'll throw the question back to you. I mean, if you're introducing these components, I'm going to guess very few people are implementing the multicast version of VXLAN, the flood and learn model. They're probably using some kind of either a controller or a control plane that may be tied to a controller in some way to distribute information between VTAPs.
Exactly, before it gets too bloody. Certainly, so in terms of multicast forwarding, we only had two clients that were doing it in POC, just to really see how it all worked. And to bring a vendor into the equation, as soon as the EVPN address family support was released on the Nexus 5000s from Cisco, I've never ever seen an upgrade so fast to move away from the multicast control plane to basically get it running on MPBGP. And, you know, basically all the stuff that the guys have been discussing is 100% valid, no doubt about it. But, you know, the BGP control plane takes all of that gumph away. It's, you know, there's not a network engineer worth his salt in my mind that doesn't know MPBGP pretty well. You know, if you've done your time, you've tried MPLS networks, you've played with MPBGP, it's something you're familiar with, so the concept of address families just make a lot of sense. And, you know, what BGP brings to the party is just all those kind of those features you wished VXLAN had seems to have been solved. Granted, you know, there'll still be stuff that people want. That's the nature of business. There's always something it doesn't quite deliver. But, you know, being able to sort of like VXLAN route right down to the leaf, the better multipathing, the just the familiarity of BGP, really. I mean, and that's the key, isn't it? It's something now that you fundamentally understand. And the layer three for me, the big thing about layer three and the reason I love it, it's not about simplicity because, you know, layer three networks are not simple. If they would, none of us would be getting $100,000 salaries. You know,
they're not simple, but they're changeable.
They're predictable.
And they don't break when you change them. They're predictable, right?
They're predictable. They do break all the time. But when they break, a good layer three network, an engineer can tell you almost to the T where the traffic is going to go to. And that's the key about layer three, predictability during failure scenarios.
Yeah, that's the main. Well, actually, it's more predictable than layer two traffic because it's never designed to have that capability.
Anything's more predictable than layer two traffic. I have a 3-year-old son called Benjamin, and he is more reliable than a layer two network.
Now, Richard, using multi-protocol BGP, as you mentioned, we've actually talked about that in some detail, Lucas, with you on a Cisco sponsored show. We got into that quite a bit, how that works and how EVPN factors into that. That's just one way to go about it. I mean, another way that was popular early on as an alternative to multicast was a controller that would populate this information into the VTAPs directly, if I remember right. Anthony, you got any comments on that?
Yeah, so there's definitely many ways to skin a cat. And we spoke earlier about how a number of customers don't want to touch multicast. Greg loves turning on multicast. And really, the reality is, for a lot of people, education is the weak point in terms of multicast. Using controller-based architectures, and I'll speak to one that I'm familiar with being something like NSX, it allows the customers to use the controller to essentially take advantage of using VXLAN with a unicast offload. So the notion is that instead of having to configure VXLAN and multicast across my environment, the controller architecture would do the learning, would do the replicating of the information that the VTAPs need to learn, the MAC address, the IP address, the VXLAN numerical identifier, and propagate that to the relevant hosts required. So that allowed a customer an easier entry into starting using overlays. So whilst it is a vendor offering, it was a different approach to what was perceived as maybe complexity in using things like the EVPN architectures, which and I see it for most customer discussions I have, is I may be not ready to configure my network like that. I can install some virtual appliances with what VMware is doing and to do that sort of stuff. It just depended on the conversation and the comfortability of the customer. Some people are looking to bring teams together. They're looking to have the network team form into with a cloudy style team, so a network is not in isolation in that cylinder of excellence, where storage isn't and compute isn't. We're able to work together.
Excellence. You've been hanging around some of the people in the, you've been hanging around some executives for far too long, boy.
No, they call them silos and business units. Come on, dude. I know they do.
That's what I'm laughing at. Cylinders of excellence is actually the corruption of the ITIL term of silos of excellence.
Then cylinders are far from excellent, I should probably say. But anyway, the notion is that they try and merge them together. And these ways were seen as quick gains to getting into, okay, I can build these overlay networks quite simply without having to worry about uphauling network. Most I walk into, turning on multicast was a relatively large change, or it would go through the ITIL meat grinder and some chickens were sacrificed as well as people's brain cells to get a change that was required to implement it, whereas deploying a virtual machine is less impacting sometimes than network changes.
Yeah, it's not
so
a critical
using
change.
Control architecture.
ITIL avoidance is significant cost savings. If you can avoid an ITIL process because there's lower risk, because it's predictable risk or predictable change, then you can actually save big money in your organization. Because the whole concept of IT as in a cost center, expensive cost center, that's why things like multicast and layer two fail, is because the cost of them is hidden in the ITIL compliance that we layer on top.
And I don't have any doubt there are companies out there who are looking for the path of least friction for these sort of things. Everyone knows change processes are awful. They're there for a reason, but ITIL's awful. And I agree with Greg since I first met him that is the way forward, to get rid of ITIL. Anyway, that's another discussion. But the notion is that things like controller flow, to do VXLAN replication, to update those VTEPs, make things like network virtualization easy to adopt, as opposed to configuring things like EVPN, which have a high overhead of configuration. Now, I'm not discrediting the way EVPN works, because there is many benefits to the way it's designed, but there are sometimes the elegance of the solution versus the simplicity of the solution are at odds with each other.
Yeah, the problem that I have with EVPN is that competency in BGP, despite what was said earlier, is actually limited. People don't know how to run a BGP system, and for them to start using EVPN in BGP, and the problem I have with BGP particularly or specifically today is that there's no way to plug a network monitoring application into it to get data out so that I can graphically show what is the current configuration of the network, because the BGP protocol has no API. You can't get in and say, are all my MAC addresses in a given location in the network? Where is it? Is it on this port? It is on that port. You actually have to deploy a management application that goes around and pulls all the MAC tables out at layer two to get that information. And just in case you're wondering, I did a show, 255 of Packet Pushers. I had Douglas Comer on the show, and he basically took the absolute mickey out of using BGP as a database because it's a stupid database. Let's just take this for example, right? If I put a MAC address into BGP and then I propagate it around my network and say, hey, my MAC address is over here, is there a guarantee that it will get to the other side? You are absolutely dependent on BGP propagating that database record, MAC address, this port, this switch, blah, blah, blah. But when it goes across the network, you will never get a signal back from the other side of the network saying, yes, I've got that information. You can never guarantee you have zero certainty that you will know where a MAC address is in the network, because BGP has not a database system. It's a near enough designed to run in a certain mode to propagate information if you're lucky, maybe.
I'll just counter that with the fact that we have somehow become completely comfortable with our entire planet running off the back of BGP. So selling the comfort of BGP to an enterprise is not overly difficult. A devil's advocate comment, but it's...
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. Sure, we do run the internet off BGP, but is the internet guaranteed to be reliable? Are you telling me that you can go out on the internet and propagate a route and know that it'll appear in Pakistan? What's your level of certainty around that?
Zero, but the whole...
Yeah. Okay, so there's your enterprise sale job. That's why you should never use BGP in the enterprise.
Well, I think the certainty in the internet that something works, it's pretty high, but it's not reliable, as you say. Greg. I mean, we have no reliability in there to prove that a route which has been, or a prefix which has been announced on one node is reaching the other node. That's the missing piece in there. We only have cross-check. But certainty with 25 years of protocol development that it kind of works now, I think that, let's call it, it's certain, but it's not reliable.
Let's say that leaded cars, we should still be running leaded fuel because we knew that worked. And it was guaranteed to treat our engines better because, you know what, when we run unleaded gas in our cars, we actually took the lead out, which actually makes the engines run worse.
I agree with you. This is why I still have my cars, old V8.
And by your logic, electric cars are just right out. We should never, ever use them because that could never be as good as petrol cars because we've got 100 years of proven reliability around that.
Yeah, deductive reasoning only works in certain scenarios, Greg, let's be honest, because by the same token, I could disprove all kinds of things, you know, or prove things on a basis of deductive reasoning. It fits in some circumstances, it doesn't in others.
Yeah, sure, I'm just rattling people's cages.
All right, kiddies, the cat herder is speaking up here because we have a goal we're trying to get to and bitching and moaning about BGP and its suitability for the task of which it is being used, whether you like it or not, is irrelevant to this conversation. So let's move along. Mostly what I'm trying to get across here is if you're trying to design VXLAN, what are the components that you need to consider? And so that's really what we've been talking about and going far, far afield into some other considerations along the way. Let's move this conversation ahead now. We're at the point where I wanted to stop almost 48 minutes into the conversation, and this should be a podcast that's done, and we're just about to get into the meat, so hang on, folks. Here we go. Let's talk first about the underlay. Okay, if I'm going to use VXLAN as an overlay, what should my underlay look like? Lucas, maybe you should start and take a stab at that.
It should be routed, I would guess, as we were talking about these LAR3 networks.
Right.
I mean, I guess this is one which definitely should be the case. The other thing is we should ensure that we allow fast convergence and multipathing, meaning either equal cost or non-equal cost, depending on the protocol you use down there. But
the point of that being VXLAN works well within an equal cost multipath environment.
It works beautiful. VXLAN has something called entropy, so we're changing the source port depending on the original flows. And with this, we have a per-flow-based kind of balancing depending on how the underlying network itself hashes. This ever-changing layer 4 source port is being handled. And just to open a bracket there, when we look in the underlying network, VXLAN is nothing else than IP-UDP traffic, if that makes sense.
Yes. No, I thought we did. IP-UDP traffic. Yes, exactly. And again, if you have built a data center that's got layer 2 domains stretched all over and you're putting this VLAN up in this Tor and it extends through the core and back to this other Tor and all, if you rethink your network in terms of VXLAN as an overlay, what you're really thinking about is I need to optimize delivery of VTEPs talking to each other. And you kind of don't care what the VTEPs have inside of them. You're really thinking from an underlay perspective about VTEP packet delivery and what does your network look like to optimize that. And contextually then, that's really what we're getting at. And so therefore, when we're talking about a layer 3 network, you're talking about building a bunch of layer 3 links within your data center to facilitate VTEP endpoint delivery, talking one to another.
Correct. You build what we call a layer 3 fabric. The leaf spine kind of topology fits very well as it facilitates equal cost multipath by having these wide spine layers giving me a resiliency as well as bandwidth. And then I can scale out basically on the leaf layer by connecting them to the spine layer. And it's automatically equal cost multipath being built in, which is basically required to have VTAP to VTAP reachability and then building the tunnels on top of that. Meaning VXLAN.
In that underlay then, that's layer 3, we've decided that's our... Now, for some of you thinking about what your data centers are, what it would take to get to a layer 3 underlay, you go, it just went, well, this is a non-starter. It ain't going to happen. Okay, but let's assume you've made that decision. You're moving ahead. Maybe you're doing greenfield deployment or you're building a new pod and you're going to build it in this sort of an image. What's a desirable underlay routing protocol? Is there a particular favorite choice any of you want to recommend?
BGP.
There it is again. Okay. For in contextually with the previous conversation, multi-protocol BGP, of course, makes really good sense.
ISIs. It's all about ISIs on my side. And there's a particular reason for that.
Okay, so let's park there for a minute. Yeah, go ahead, Lucas. Why ISIs?
Okay, so first of all, today most networks are being built based on IPv4. With ISIs, I'm actually completely IP-less. When I want to change my underlay to IPv6, I don't have to change anything. It's not like OSPF version 2 to OSPF version 3 and then working with the address families. I can just leave my network as it is. The second piece in ISIs, which is pretty interesting, is how SPF calculations actually happen in a change of your underlying network, and this comes into how stable my overall network is. In ISI, as I said, we're IP-less. We're using CLNS for all the protocols, and that means a router is actually a system, and the link is just a connectivity between two systems in that case. If a link fails, there is no global SPF recalculation. Versus in OSPF, if you do exactly the same, as it's IP-based and all the link are IP prefixes, if there is a link flap or a link change, I get global SPF recalculation. So these are kind of the reasons why I'm seeing ISIs there as a superior protocol for an underlay. It gives me flexibility, IP-less, as well as great stability in there. Unfortunately, a lot of people are not very well experienced in it. That's the big disadvantage.
Well, there's another question I would raise to you as well. If you're going to use ISIS in the underlay, do you then run BGP on top of it for control plane communications? It's starting to look like a service provider network.
That's a good question. And if I'm going to use EVPN, I probably go, yes, with multi-protocol BGP on top of it. And there is a reason also why I want to have these two different protocols in there. And yes, it looks pretty much like a service provider network afterwards, which has been proven, or at least some have been proven they're stable and know what they're doing. Now, so go back there. So in EVPN, I'm using MPBGP, and I do not want to mix actually my overlay control plane with my underlay control plane, as my underlay is very slick, lean, small. Only point-to-point links and the VTAPs are known in there. It's only there for reachability, for building my topology, while in my overlay control plane, I'm having all my end hosts in there. So I have a lot of information which I have to learn first. So if I overlap these two things together in a single control plane, I have to wait until I've learned everything, until I can forward recursive, next hop lookup, and all of that crap being in there. If I separate this, as long as ISIS or the underlying control plane is not ready, my overlay control plane will not even have a reachability or will not even have a peering up from that sake. And that means we're not trying to send something before we even can.
What about OSPF as an underlay that a lot of folks might consider? And conversely, EIGRP?
OSPF works very well, as said before. The only thing I had to mention about that was make sure you use point-to-point and be aware on how SPF calculations work. But that's all it. I mean, it works very well, and I see a lot of networks using OSPF. EIGRP, does it still exist?
This from a guy that works at Cisco. I imagine you maybe are seeing customers that still use EIGRP, and sure, it's out there, but...
No, it's out there. I haven't seen it a lot as an underlay network in the data centers, specifically not for VXLAN, as these networks are being built mostly recently, and people are looking always on this open and standard kind of approach where OSPF and ISIs fits very well.
I'll have to get Donnie Savage and Russ White on in defense of EIGRP and see if it has a future. Interesting comment that you're not seeing much of it out there.
I was just thinking there's some howls coming from certain people that we know right now.
That's right.
I'm waiting for their emails. I'm waiting for their emails. They can beat me down on this one.
Well, the revival there is EIGRP OTP, isn't it? That's the let's inject some lifeblood into the protocol, but that's for another day.
Yeah.
Richard, just for a point of reference, what protocols do you typically see people running in your customers as their underlay?
Very, very often OSPF or BGP. Yeah, I'm not just being controversial or trying to be funny, Greg, but in all seriousness, I mean, OSPF and BGP are the two we see most often. EIGRP very seldom, specifically because of the fact that it's not open. And I know there is an RFP that other vendors can now use it, but no one's really pushing it. So yeah, fundamentally, mostly OSPF, particularly because there's not a product that doesn't support it as a routing protocol. It's pretty rock solid. Huge.
Yeah, they're all good things. Again, but my problem is, where's my visibility? I'm running into problems now where I've got data centers with 500 nodes in them, and I've got zero visibility running the OSPF protocol about what's actually happening in the packet flows.
Yeah, fair enough, but that's what's happening in the real world, Greg.
Yes, but I'm saying, but that's not what I need tomorrow. When I get into enterprise data centers that go from 100 physical switches to 100 physical switches and 400 virtual appliances, instead of having one pair of load balancers at the top, I've got 30 of them. I need new ways of changing things. That's my. I'm more looking. Don't tell me what you're going to do today. That's all solved.
It's called a controller.
I don't want to get into the controller, but I want APIs on my path mechanisms so I can get visibility into the actual paths in my network. What is the real path? So I can chart it in a diagram. So if I say this server connects to this server, I should be able to interrogate the NIC. I should be able to interrogate the virtual switch, the physical switch, the firewalls, the load balancers, the blah, 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 and track the path through the network, because there's APIs in the OSPF, in the routing protocol or the path protocols, and in all those appliances that I can actually stitch it all together.
Now, Lucas, I'm going to throw a question at you here. You had written in the notes in our shared Google Doc making a distinction between a layer 3 underlay and a layer 3 fabric, which I've written and read about that term fabric quite a lot over the years, but I don't think I could clearly articulate that difference. How would you describe it?
Sure, absolutely. So the layer 3 fabrics are mostly a construct we're seeing in the MSDC world, or in very modern data centers where no requirement for any L2 is actually present. So when I'm building these layer 3 fabrics, I'm still going back in these kind of class architectures, leaf spine, point-to-point network, point-to-point links, and building a routing protocol on top of it. And there's actually a very, very nice document about that, or actually, in the meantime, I think it's a draft or an RFC and IETF, which is talking about, for example, using BGP in that case. The difference is, in the layer 3 fabrics, my subnet is mostly localized to a given switch. So it looks more like I have a subnet behind a PE, and then the PE is connected to the network itself. So it's a very, very static kind of way in regards to BGP updates, only if really something fails, there is an update going on. Otherwise, it's very stable. The layer 3 underlay itself provides kind of, and I alluded that before, kind of only reachability information in VTAPs, and that's one of the difference. We don't have user payload in there or network payload, host payload in there. And so there are a little bit of different requirements happening in there. It's much smaller routing tables in a layer 3 underlay versus in a layer 3 fabric. And when we're now going, for example, and taking all the learnings of a layer 3 fabric, of that big routed kind of approach, and put it in the underlay, we're completely kind of overload our underlay itself. And we're also going in the direction of maybe saying, hey, I have now that L3 fabric built. I built it based on that nice MSDC design. I used BGP for that, and now I'm going to use BGP EVPN for the overlay control plane. And now I'm merging basically underlay and overlay control plane again together. So this is why we're alluding a little bit in there when going into the discussion of layer 3 fabrics versus layer 3 underlay and the different requirements which are actually there.
Okay, so now we've got some idea of our underlay. We've picked a routing protocol. We've got a design in mind, whether that's CLOS, i.e. leaf spine architecture. We've got the underpinnings, the foundation to begin deploying VTAPs and standing up VXLAN tunnels between these VTAPs. So let's talk about VXLAN traffic specifically now, because we've got some different classes of traffic. There's unicast traffic, there's multicast and broadcast traffic that would be within the context of VXLAN, and then managing that sort of traffic. Anthony, do you have some thoughts along the lines here, the special considerations of the different kinds of traffic we're going to be pushing through the VXLAN overlay and how that might tie back to the underlay?
I think, first of all, one thing that people may overlook when getting excited is MTU. I know it's a given, but sometimes that discussion comes up in environments. MTU, obviously, if you are using VXLAN, you have an encapsulation overhead. So that does impact your design of your environment. If you're talking a greenfields environment, sure, we can set the switches to 9,000 or anything higher than 1,600.
Yeah, the wave of the wand I always see in vendor white papers is, yeah, we just use jumbo frames and that solves the problem. And which if you already have an environment, it may not be so simple as just to wave that magic wand.
Do you know how hard it is to get a carrier to actually say, yes, we support jumbo frames?
This is where it comes down to that do supporting the do not fragment bit, right? With VXN standard says not to fragment.
Yes, and all sorts of silly things. And it's just very hard to get your carrier. I've actually had problems where getting my WAN provider to actually say, yes, I support oversized frames, much less jumbo frames, was impossible. They didn't know. Nobody knew.
Yeah, and that's the thing as well, is that you need to understand that, yes, we can wave a wand in white papers as you make out, or your SE comes along and says, yeah, just enable VXLAN, no worries, it's fine. You know, MCU, no issue at all. You know, you're using jumbo frames of storage, all good, right? But the reality is that is a consideration, and it's something you need to consider in, especially brownfield. Like brownfield, that's a major change, because depending on the switch vendor, you may need to reboot the switch. Life is a line card change, port change. You have to reboot the entire daughter card, line card,
yes,
or the entire switch. And that's an outage. And given that most, if you're adding a spine leaf topology onto an existing three-tiered network, you may have to consider how the traffic flow is going to be, what's in the existing network, a whole number of considerations. So brownfield environment, be careful. Your mileage may vary. In a greenfields environment, well, for most applications, for most environments that I've come across, using an MTU of 9,000 is generally what's used due for storage requirements. And given the air quoting here, it is hyperconvergence, is that the notion of storage isn't baked into where your, if it's a network virtualization solution or where your VTEPs are placed on the servers as opposed to the switch, you may find that you have 9,000 end-to-end by default. So that is something in consideration that varies between greenfield and brownfield environments. It's more so about how you're going to go about implementing it.
In a VXLAN environment, what does, let's say, a broadcast look like? And let's wrap a specific and very common scenario around it. I am a host. I have no idea that there's VXLAN in front of me. I'm just putting an ARP on the wire because I'm trying to talk to some other IP address out there and need to know how to build that frame. What happens when I do that?
For me, in a controller architecture, if you want me to speak to control architecture, the notion is I can learn and replicate my information to my other VTEPs in my group. So if a broadcast comes out, I can take that information. Well, actually, I know of the other workloads on the same segment as myself. I know the MAC address, the IP address, that is replicated to other hosts that participate with that VNI on the same segment. And as workload is stood up onto that segment, that's passed to the other hosts that represent the host that the workload sits on. So in a controller-based architecture, we can deal with that traffic because we're learning about where a workload is.
So in other words, you see the ARP, you know where every endpoint is throughout the environment, you're saying. The controller is aware of that as systems come up on the wire. And so there's an interception of the ARP packet and someone else replies to it, or?
So that's probably a good thing to explain a bit further. So if you look into something like a unicast mode style replication where your controller will take the MAC address, the IP address, and the VXLAN numerical identifier, in my case, pass it through a message bus back to the controller cluster, where that will disseminate information back down to the hosts that are participating on that VXLAN segment. Then that would replicate information from, you know, centrally manage and then push that around in a distributed fashion. That's then unicast to hosts in the same transport zone and unicast to other hosts in remote transport zones. So that's in terms of using a VXLAN as a part of an overlay on top of a network itself.
The key here being it's not a blind broadcast to everything. It's a broadcast that is replicated to specific places that it needs to go.
Absolutely. So this is not just every single host in an environment, this would be members that have a workload on that same segment. You could draw it down to ARP suppression.
Hey, the interesting thing here to note is that a lot of us have built up mental views of how many broadcasts exist. If you actually do packet sniff on a modern data center network, broadcasts are actually quite limited in the sense that in a TCP/IP environment, you don't see that many broadcasts. And so the ability of a software switch or a software device to do unicast replication like this, or pseudo broadcast, as I heard someone talk about it, is perfectly viable, because you're usually only talking like, I'm going to replicate one broadcast to, worst case, 200 hosts on average. You don't normally have, you know, /16 subnets. You might have /22. So if you're going to replicate a packet even to 1,000 hosts, that's well within the capabilities of a software switch.
Absolutely. And that's something that coupled with the previous conversation about not using things like multicast in your switching infrastructure, allow an easier road to start deploying some of these overlay technologies. That's where there are benefits to a controller-based architecture, as opposed to configuring your physical underlay to be supportive of this.
So Lucas, a good time to describe a different way that this might happen. Let's assume...
You want me to contrast that with how it works in EVPN?
Yeah, exactly. Do it. In other words, we don't necessarily have a central controller that's dealing with this. We've got a more what a network engineer would think of as a traditional control plane. How do we deal with broadcast traffic in a VXLAN environment?
Sure, absolutely. It works pretty similar as explained. So my end host sends just whatever kind of broadcast traffic. We will send it to our top of rack switch or whatever kind of VTAP it is. We will basically look up, is it an ARP request or is it any other kind of broadcast type?
Be more specific.
The switch. Okay. The ingress VTAP will basically look at the packet itself if it is specific to ARP. If it's not, we're forwarding it into either the multicast group, which is responsible for the VNI, replicated to the other VTAPs, which are serving that VNI, or we are replicating the packet with ingress replication to the VTAPs, which are serving that given VNI. So a broadcast will not go down to who is a given host behind a VTAP. We will just assume that if a VNI is configured on a given VTAP, that there is an interested host being back there, which needs to process the broadcast itself.
Again, VNI being VXLAN network identifier, kind of like a VLAN tag.
Correct. But with ARP, there is a specific handling which we are doing. This is why I'm differentiating a little bit between ARP and just a simple other kind of broadcast there. As whenever we're sending out an ARP from an end host towards the VTAP, we will make a lookup in EVPN control plane, meaning the VTAP, the ingressing VTAP, will make a lookup against the EVPN control plane. And if the destination IP where we're sending the ARP request to is known, we answer locally. So we're not sending anything out towards the rest of all the other nodes there.
There's intelligence there. It's not just going to be a blind, broadcast it off to everyone and wait for the endpoint on the other end to reply. It's, we can localize that response because we already know the answer. It's already been advertised to us in the BGP control plane.
Correct. That's the case. And on top of that, we are also have silent host handling in there. So if a host would not be known to the control plane, we would send it forward the respective destination multicast group where the VNI is mapped to, and respectively then on the answer of, meaning when we reach the destination host, which we are ARPing for, we are going to update the control plane. And so a host is really just silent or unknown for the time until somebody in the overall network ARPed once for him and we were able to capture the packet.
Got it. Okay. Now, is there in either of these architectures such a thing as an unknown unicast? So traditionally with a switch, if your MAC table has not learned about a particular MAC address, you have what is known as unknown unicast flooding. The MAC, the switch receives the frame inbound, says, I don't know where this goes. Everybody gets it. And then when he learns via response, if there is one where it goes, he updates his bridging table and you shouldn't have that problem in the future until that times out again. So in VXLAN, where there's so much knowledge about endpoints in advance and everyone's exchanging information one with another, either in the viewpoint Anthony's coming from, controller, or a control plane viewpoint, it's all exchanged. What do we do with unknown unicast, or is there such a thing?
To answer it from the more network-centric side, meaning the EVPN side, the chance of unknown unicast is very, very little to zero. And even if it exists for a very, very little time, until the control plane has converged, meaning all the ARP messages and MAC address table have been exchanged. But there is theoretically no unknown unicast in a control plane-based network with VXLAN EVPN.
For me, a way to describe that would be, I consider now, you know, overlay environment, a frame is considered unknown unicast if a host or a VTEP does not have the MAC address in its cached entry. So if it doesn't, if there's some reason it doesn't, in my inner control, it republishes that information, you know, broadcast out, but otherwise, you know, it's sent out to all VTEPs for that given VXLAN. But otherwise, I only consider unknown unicast if a host does not have the corresponding MAC address to VTEP IP cached entry.
Right. It sounds like the same thing in both scenarios. It's pretty rare that you should actually have an unknown unicast. Those entries are known and maintained for lots of reasons in real time. But on the chance that there is something that shows up on the wire that's not known already, there is a controlled flooding mechanism that happens so that can be learned.
Well, I mean, the flip side here is the only time you need to care about unknown bum traffic, whether it's broadcast, unknown unicast, or multicast, is when you have the potential for loops. That's the technical risk around it. And then if you take that out by having an overlay network where you can't actually loop, then you don't have the same panic or fear of risk attached to that. So then what happens is, and what we're talking about here is, how does the software decide to broadcast or replicate a frame? I just wanted to reframe that and say you don't need to worry about unknown unicast in an overlay network because the edge points know about every other edge point.
Yeah, it's actually one step ahead on that one. In the upcoming software releases, we actually have a knob to completely suppress unknown unicast. So even if there is some, we're able to just disable it. As with the control plane information, the ARP suppression and all these information being exchanged in a very efficient way, there is literally no unknown unicast. So even if it happens, I can actually suppress it. And this can also lead into an improvement on the layer 2 loop protection set, because it actually, VXLAN can loop if I build an external connectivity between two VTEPs. Extending the VLAN VNI. This will be a loop, but with all these control plane functionality and the suppression of unknown unicast, this is not happening to that extent anymore.
Okay, so we've got in a lot of good detail about what's actually happening under the hood, some different scenarios of what traffic flow looks like through a VXLAN environment. And some of the more unusual cases. So let's close the podcast by just kind of going around the table with some parting thoughts, points that maybe you wanted to make that we haven't made so far, or maybe a lesson learned from real life deployment, or a war story you wanted to share, something like that. So let's go around the table one more time, and let's start with Richard.
Yeah, I think we've pretty much covered most of the stuff that I'd sort of, when I talk to a customer, be those catch-alls. I think, very much a case of understand the flexibility that VXLAN has the potential to bring to your environment, which is great, but understand exactly that VXLAN is not the magic wand that solves your layer 3 versus layer 2 question. As any good network design requires, there needs to be consideration, planning, thought into traffic paths, blackouts, brownouts, all sorts of failure scenarios. This is not the silver bullet that solves our layer 2 vMotion problem. It helps, absolutely. It makes a couple of complications go away. It does remove some exposure to that layer 2 risk. But as with anything, you just need to be clever about it. Take consideration of the intricacies of the protocol. And the guys today have covered a lot of great things. So, that's really the biggest one for me. I think the other thing is that when I speak to a client about whether they do or don't want to implement VXLAN, the main thing for me is you need to fundamentally understand the nature of the way your chosen vendor supports the protocol. because there may be things that are done differently, you know, certain features you think that they're there that aren't. And it's going to be, again, we had it last time. It's those little things that are going to catch you out. That's really it from me.
And Anthony?
Some good things there. It's been a really great way to see the two different ways of doing it in the hardware and different in software. But what I think people realize is that this is another tool for the toolbox. This is, as Richard made a point, this isn't going to cure cancer, world hunger, solve all the problems in the world. This is just one more tool to give us flexibility in our data center networks, whether it's because you want to use vMotion, and yes, I apologize on behalf of VMware for bringing layer 2 requirements to the data center for vMotion, because that really is the number one reason why people want layer 2 connectivity these days. But it's something that is flexibility from independent from the switching infrastructure below you. It is a tool that can be used to provide connectivity for workloads, but do understand the use case and requirements for it. Not everyone needs it from day one, but if you are starting to use it, understand it, how it is done. And I think I'm echoing Rich exactly here. Know how solution A versus solution B implement VXLAN, because it's same, but different.
And then Lucas.
What should I say? I mean, I concur pretty much with the two gentlemen before me. That's that's beautiful, right? So different, but still the same. Now, it's really important to understand where VXLAN fits from a use case perspective, how it actually works, and how I get it work. It's not just a copy paste of a couple of CLI lines. Please understand the protocol and use it appropriately, depending on the use cases, and it gives you flexibility, and it's actually a pretty nice and lean protocol from that perspective. So that's I think it from my side. Love it. I mean, it's fun to look at new stuff.
Okay, very good. Well, Anthony, thanks particularly to you for you. It's you've been ill. It's now I think 2:30 in the morning where you are, and so starting with you, we'll give you a chance to sign off here. How can folks follow you on the internet?
Don't I get to say something?
In a minute, I'm getting to you, boy. Anthony, thanks, go ahead.
It was a good bit of fun, and it was nice to have a chat. But I think it's people can find me on the internet. I'm at pandem_ on Twitter, and I blog occasionally at Network Inferno. If you want to talk anything about networking, network virtualization, you know where to find me. I am one of those vendor people who try not to be a vendor person. Let's see how people think of me now, but I'm here for a good old chin wag, and I'm an Aussie, and I hope I didn't sound too much like a transvestite.
Just enough, but not too much. Richard, what about you?
If you guys want to follow me on Twitter, it's R.A. Logicalis. I'll apologize in advance. It is a lot of corporate messaging, but such is the nature of our world. I can also be followed on our Logicalis group blog called CXO Unplugged. So there's a couple of things on there. And yeah, I mean, there's a couple of independent articles floating around that if you Google for it, you're bound to find me. But outside of that, keep your eyes peeled for my face floating around World Cup rugby here in the UK. I'm going to be torn between to shout for England or South Africa should we both get to the final. But I'm guessing I'm probably going to have to sing for the green and gold. So go Boca.
Then Lucas.
Thanks a lot. You guys can find me on Twitter occasionally. It's at CCIE21921. LinkedIn is another option. Meet me virtual or in person at Cisco Live. And in the near future, we are also having some Cisco Press Live lesson on VXLAN, which I think it would be a good Christmas present.
And then, Greg, your parting thoughts on this whole thing, and then, of course, your usual plug.
Okay, so two things here. One thing is we never talked about anything to do with hardware today, which is unusual, but great, because overlay networks are almost, you don't care what actual switches are underneath. And I think that just highlights that. And the second thing was that the one thing that we can't do with VXLAN today is get visibility and management out of it. So all the things that we talked about today, nobody actually wanted to mention that they needed to see inside of it or know what their paths are. Because when you start putting overlays over the top of your physical, where is it that you're actually going? Because you can't go into your routers and do a show IP over SPF route and see exactly what's going on, because your overlay doesn't necessarily work that way. You need to have visibility. So don't just go out and buy, you know, vandalize your network with a VXLAN overlay without thinking really, really carefully about how you're going to see inside about where your packets are going. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com, on the Twitters is at etherealmind. And if you really want to hear a scathing criticism of BGP, sign up for show 255 and listen to Douglas Comer. That is Professor Douglas Comer, who wrote the textbooks that you did in your very early study. And he'll tell you why you shouldn't be using BGP for anything. I'm not the only person. Thank you.
And I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. And of course, this has been the Packet Pushers podcast at packetpushers.net. This is the weekly show. We put one of these out just about every week. And just to remind you, we've got this show and several other ones in our channel, including Data Knots, where I and Chris Wall go on and on about data center stuff, not just networking, but also storage and virtualization and so on, with a lot of great guests. And the Priority Queue, where if you liked really nerdy conversations like this that seemed kind of heavy and got into some of the corners, you'd really like Priority Queue, because we go into some even deeper, darker corners and cover a lot of stuff. And we've got several recordings in the queue that are going to be hitting Priority Queue before too long. And then, of course, Network Break, news and analysis from the networking and IT industry. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. If you have any thoughts or comments about this show, please share packetpushers@gmail.com or go up to packetpushers.net and leave a comment on the blog post that will accompany this show. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.